Scotia, 34 Racine, 30 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind chill is 2 above. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one of today's program will feature a newly recorded interview with Jeffrey Toobin examining the presidential pardon. Parts two and three will both be related to Women's History Month with interesting interviews out of the morning show archives. Here's part one. In this portion of WGTD's morning show, we're going to be talking about the power of the presidential pardon, something which generated headlines in the closing hours of the Joe Biden administration when he issued a number of pardons, including several to members of his own family. And presidential pardons continued to generate headlines in the opening hours of President Trump's second administration when he issued sweeping pardons of those convicted of the January 6th rioting on Capitol Hill. In the wake of all that, has been considerable discussion about the nature of presidential pardons, of where this power comes from, why it was given to the president, if this is a power that we fully understand and appreciate, and if it is a power that should remain in place. One very thoughtful book on the topic has just been written by Jeffrey Toobin, a longtime CNN legal commentator and the author of 10 books, including The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson, and Homegrown, Timothy McVeigh and the Rise of Right-Wing Extremism. His new book is titled The Pardon, The Politics of Presidential Mercy. Jeffrey Toobin, we welcome you to the morning show. I'm really honored to be speaking with you today.
Hi, Gregory.
So your book, of course, in so many respects, could not be more timely, even though you actually finished the book ahead of the end of the Biden administration and the beginning of the Trump administration, when, of course, the matter of presidential pardons emerged in very, very dramatic fashion, and we'll get to that in just a moment. One of the key points made by your book is to help us understand the roots of this notion of the presidential pardon. I mean, where this idea came from. And I think you see something rather odd in the origins of that, because we're talking about a kind of authority that resided with the British king. Tell us more about the origins of this notion of the presidential pardon and the way in which it's kind of surprising that it was important to the founding fathers.
Well, you know, it's really a fascinating story, because the Constitution, the pardon is an anomaly under the Constitution. Most of the Constitution is based on the idea of checks and balances. But there is no check and balance when it comes to the pardon. The pardon is the part of the Constitution most directly descended from the royal prerogative of the kings of England. And it was brought in after the Articles of Confederation failed, and Alexander Hamilton and others came up with the idea of a president who had a central authority. And to the surprise of some, and it was controversial at the time, they included the pardon power. And Hamilton justified it as a way of dispensing mercy But in fact, even at the time, several people in the Constitutional Convention were worried that it gave too much power to the president to overrule the entire criminal justice system. And that tension between mercy and the power of the president is something that has been in evidence throughout American history since then.
We shouldn't take very much time with this, but can you just give us a brief sense of why, for instance, the King of England was granted this kind of authority? I mean, what was the basis of this coming about in the first place within the British monarchy?
Well, and this goes back to the very, very early days of the British monarchy. And you have to remember, in those days, the king was an absolute monarch. So he... the pardon was just a naturally folded in power, the power to dispense mercy, the power to overturn convictions, was just seen as a natural royal prerogative.
Because but they were free to do essentially anything, I suppose.
Anything they wanted. But as soon as Parliament began asserting itself in the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, one of the things they did was start to limit the pardon power. And what they one limitation was, if Parliament voted an impeachment, the king could not overturn an impeachment. And that is true in the American Constitution as well. And of course it makes sense, because the president could be impeached, and you can't have a power that the president can undo his own impeachment. So the only limitation on the pardon power is one that also comes from the English Constitution.
We're speaking with Jeffrey Toobin about his book, The Pardon, The Politics of Presidential Mercy. So one of the notions that you have in your book, or one of the central tenets of your book, is that to whatever extent presidential pardons seem to be misused in the current scene, or misused perhaps used in some reckless ways, you trace this back to our 38th president, Gerald Ford, and to
right.
the pardon which he extended to our 37th president, Richard Nixon. One of the things you do in your book is kind of tell us the story of what unfolded essentially behind the scenes and the sort of delicate dance that occurred that ultimately led to this pardon being issued by the new president. Tell our listeners why, beyond just the fact that it's interesting, why it's important for us to kind of understand the delicacy of how this particular pardon came about, and the, in a sense, the groundwork that it laid for pardons to come.
The thesis of my book is that presidents reveal themselves through pardons. It's like an X-ray into the presidential soul. And the dance that went on between Ford and Nixon in 1974 is a perfect illustration of that. There have been suspicions over the years that there was some sort of corrupt deal made, that Nixon agreed to give Ford the presidency in return for a pardon. And I... examine the evidence closely on that issue and conclude that there was no such deal, that Ford did not and would not have made a deal like that. However, it was Nixon's scheming character that allowed him to manipulate the process in a way where he would get a pardon. And Ford, who was, in comparison, a babe in the woods, didn't fully realize the stakes and the outcome of what he was doing, and that was a huge development in the Ford presidency. Frankly, it's the only thing most people remember Gerald Ford from, which is giving the pardon. But anyway, So that story of the Nixon pardon is really at the heart of my book.
And what you summarize that pardon as a bad pardon for an honorable reason. And I should say, I am old enough to remember the pardon, and I remember my father, who was no fan of Richard Nixon, saying that the reason he regretted that pardon being given was that he really wanted to see what would happen to Nixon if, in a sense, the wheels of justice had continued with a trial before the U.S. Senate. And he, in a sense, felt robbed of that experience. So on kind of a selfish personal level, he kind of resented being robbed of that experience. And, of course, President Ford extended that pardon exactly so the nation would be spared that, which is an interesting
thing. But that's not selfish. That wasn't selfish on the part of your father. Your father was asking for accountability. He was asking for equal protection of the laws. He was asking for Nixon to be treated just like his aides, H.R. Haldeman, John Ehrlichman, John Mitchell, who were going on trial for the Watergate cover-up that Nixon instigated and Nixon was the beneficiary of. And it was deeply unfair that they all faced trial and all went to prison, even though Nixon got away with no sanction because of the pardon. So it's not just, oh, we would have liked to have had an interesting TV show. It was, I thought, a true misuse of the pardon power because it contributed to the impression, which pardons often have, that powerful people get a different kind of justice and a better kind of justice than ordinary Americans.
Right. Well, of course, in the waning days, even minutes, of the Biden administration, he did, of course, pardon his son Hunter and five other members of his family, and then the brand new President Trump, essentially on his first day, commuted the sentence of more than 1,500 people involved in the riots at the Capitol on January 6th. We are partly in this situation because, as you say, this is a power given to the president that has no curbs or balances at all, and perhaps it was a power granted to them in a sense in haste or without careful consideration. Is there a way for us to move beyond this, those of us who might share your concern about this unlimited presidential pardon power? Is there a way to walk this back somehow, to curb this ability to grant pardon? Or has that ship already irrevocably sailed?
There's only one way: elect better presidents. Because the Constitution is not going to change. The Constitution is very difficult to amend, and there's no pressure to amend it. And I think, you know, again, this is the thesis of the book. You have the presidents reveal their strengths and weaknesses through pardons. I think the president who wielded the power most admirably was Barack Obama, who didn't pardon any of his friends, but he did issue 1,500 commutations to low-level drug offenders who were in prison for longer than they should have been. That, to me, is an appropriate use of the pardon power. Rewarding your friends and relatives like Biden did, and certainly rewarding violent criminals, unrepentant violent criminals like the January 6th rioters, was a terrible misuse of the power. But there is no check and balance, and that's that. As far as the law is concerned, the pardon is the end of the story.
The book is The Pardon: The Politics of Presidential Mercy, published by Simon & Schuster, the author Jeffrey Toobin. Jeffrey Toobin, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for writing this fascinating book.
Thanks, Gregory.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you now from the Morning Show archives, both of which align with the theme of Women's History Month. And here is part two of today's program. We are going to be exploring some amazing stories for the next few minutes about some amazing women. The book at hand is called Wonder Women, 25 innovators, inventors, and trailblazers who changed history. But the names are going to be names that will be all but completely unknown to you, or at least they were to me. And that's so exciting to read a book which introduces us to incredible women who did incredible things, but whose stories are largely lost to us until that is the good work of Sam Meggs, an assistant writer for BioWare, author of The Fangirl's Guide to the Galaxy, and the author of this new book, Wonder Women, published by Quirk Books. Sam Meggs, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really like the way this book is laid out with five sections: women of science, women of medicine, women of espionage, women of innovation, and finally, women of adventure. At one point in your book, you point out a facet of this that I think is worth talking about. In one reason why we don't know so much about women astronomers, for instance, or women mathematicians, is because there weren't as many of them, because there were all kinds of doors shut to women. But that's not the whole story. Your book also points out that in some cases, men actually sort of swooped in and sort of snatched away credit that rightfully belonged to women who had actually come up with a given innovation, and that your book is an effort to right some of history's wrongs. Can you give our listeners one or two examples of a historical wrong in which a man took credit for something that a woman, in fact, had accomplished?
Yeah, that's definitely an unfortunate common theme throughout the book. I mean, so many women throughout history have had amazing accomplishments in STEM that have either been erased by time, or they weren't able to take credit for because of their gender or race, or like you say, in this case, stolen by their male colleagues. I think the most famous example of this, which I touch on briefly in the book, is Rosalind Franklin, who discovered the structure of DNA only to have it stolen by Watson and Crick, who we read about in our textbooks now. In Wonder Women, I talk about Alice Ball, who was the first woman and first African-American to get a master's degree from the University of Hawaii in 1915. And at just 23, she invented a cure for leprosy, the first viable cure for leprosy, but died as a complication from the process of that invention. And her male boss was like, I got this invention I came up with recently, and took credit for it. And the cure was named after him, which is very unfortunate. Another example of this in the book is Margaret Knight, who was actually, in the early 1900s, the woman who invented the machine that makes flat-bottomed paper bags. So when you get takeout food and you put it in a paper bag, she invented that. But she actually she had to sue for her patent after her design was stolen by a man who had seen it and tried to claim it as his own. And his main defense was that a woman couldn't possibly have created something so ingenious. So she won, of course, because she made it, but it was pretty rough.
Right. One of the things that's really clear is that although, for instance, I found this book just endlessly fascinating and revelatory, you clearly have written this book with younger readers in mind, or maybe not exclusively younger readers in mind, but for instance, when we read at one point that this is a journey into the history of bad-as-heck babes, that tells us that this is a book written not so much for college professors to read as it is maybe for young girls to really derive some inspiration. Talk about that.
Accessible as possible, because I think when a lot of people think about history books, they think about really boring tomes or textbooks or really things that are really impenetrable to most people or uninteresting. You know, I wanted to approach this topic in as friendly and approachable and humorous a way as possible, because, you know, there are so many injustices done to women and to these women in particular that if you don't laugh about it, you're going to cry, I think, first of all. And also, I think we see a real lack of role models in STEM fields of science, technology, engineering, and math for young women. So it was really important to me to be able to bring these stories to the forefront so that girls who want to get into these fields, who maybe want to get into coding or video games or engineering, can look at this book, particularly women of color and queer women whose stories are almost never told, and say, look, women like me have been successful at this before. Maybe I can be successful at this too.
I was really amazed that so many of these women were so far back in history. I really wasn't expecting some of these stories to reach really into ancient times, or just back further than I would have thought was possible in terms of women enjoying these kind of tremendous accomplishments. It's quite exciting. I think it would actually be really interesting in terms of giving our listeners some idea of that, to talk about the very first woman you speak about in the book, the first biography in the section of Women of Science. You talk about an extraordinary astronomer from China from the 18th century. Talk about her and what she accomplished.
Oh, absolutely. Her name was Wang Zhenyi, and she was born in 1768 in China, where women were basically just sewing and having babies and weren't allowed to go to school, and, you know, all that stuff that happened in the 1700s wasn't so great. But she actually became a highly accomplished astronomer and mathematician and poet, and was the first person using a model that she built in her garden using a fountain and some other practical effects, was the first person to discover how eclipses worked. So she made kind of a whole, you know, grade school science experiment that was modeled the movement of the sun and the moon and the earth. And this was while in the West we were still figuring out whether the earth was flat or not. She was like, I know how eclipses work. Meanwhile, in China, this woman in the 1700s figured out eclipses, so pretty impressive.
Right. And you tell us about the protest poetry that she also wrote. I mean, she was a well-rounded woman, and we so appreciate hearing about that. We hear about a Chinese inventor of textile technology who dates back actually to the 13th century. And I'm just really impressed that you were able to uncover such wide-ranging stories spanning so much of world history. What kind of a challenge was that for you to uncover the stories of some of these women who are simply not represented in standard history books or textbooks?
Oh, thank you for saying that. Yeah, I think we often have a really white sort of Western view of things. We hear a lot about British and American women, and I do have those women in the book, but we often forget that women in India and China and Japan and Peru and all over the world were also making great strides throughout history and science. So I really wanted to try to make the book as diverse as possible, but it was definitely a challenge, more of a challenge, to dig up those stories, because those narratives in particular are really buried. So I did a lot of research, a lot of looking back into women's history textbooks, history of medicine textbooks. One resource that I really enjoyed using in the States was a website called Chronicling America, which is a newspaper website that archives all old newspapers throughout the States from the 1800s to the early 1900s. So if you want to find out what was going on in your community in, say, 1860, you can go ahead and log on to that website and take a look at the newspaper from that day in history. And it's super fascinating. All kinds of lost stories you can find that way.
Right. I want to make sure that you mention one of my favorite women from this book, Maria Sibylla Merian, a German explorer who set off on an extraordinary journey to South America that is really probably one of the first journeys of its kind in which someone traveled halfway around the world really for the sake of science rather than commerce.
That's right, yeah. So she was born in 1647 in Germany, and she wanted to become a painter, even though women weren't even allowed to use oil paint at that time, based on guild rules. But what she really enjoyed painting were insects and the environment in which insects thrived. So she traveled all the way to South America. It was the first self-funded scientific journey ever, because no one would fund a woman to go to America for science. So she sent herself and her daughter, and actually was the first person to catalog a ton of South American entomology. And some of her paintings are still the only examples that we have of insects that have since become extinct. So she was pretty cool.
Incredible. Before we have to let you go, I want to make sure you talk about the appendix at the back of the book, which is called How to Become a Woman of Wonder. Explain what that's about.
I really want wanted this book to sort of act as a resource for young women or women of any age, really, or people of any age to feel empowered to be able to do these things for themselves if they felt inspired by the women in this book. So I just compiled a list of resources and, companies and programs right now that you can get involved in. If you're interested in this sort of stuff, like Girls Who Code, if you want to learn how to be a programmer at any age, you can learn how to make your own video game, all sorts of women exploration groups and things that you can join to either learn or help out women in your community who want to learn.
The book, again, is titled Wonder Women, 25 Innovators, Inventors, and Trailblazers Who Changed Histories, published by Quirk Books, and the author, Sam Maggs. Sam Maggs, congratulations on a terrific book. I'm glad we got to talk about it. Best wishes.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. To finish out today's program, we're going to be hearing from a 2012 interview that I did with Virginia Scharf, who at the time was a professor of history at the University of New Mexico. She was one of the participants in a really fascinating American Experience documentary that aired that week on Annie Oakley, one of the most extraordinary figures of the Old West. Here's a portion of our conversation from 2012. Tell us how you became involved in this project. I mean, does the phone just ring one day and somebody tells you they're making a film about Annie Oakley? Or, I mean, is it as simple as that?
It's pretty much as simple as that. But basically, I get the call because I've been writing for many years now about women in the American West, and I've spent a lot of my scholarly energy on that task. So Annie Oakley is someone who inevitably I would have come across, and of course she's such a fascinating figure. I just wanted to know more about her.
Absolutely. I'm so glad to learn more about her. I remember first learning about her in something called Childcraft, which was the children's version of World Book Encyclopedia.
I remember it myself.
Okay,
absolutely.
Yeah, right. And one of the volumes, which is devoted to interesting people in history or something, has this story. And from the sounds of it in the documentary, it sounds like they got that story exactly right about the first meeting between Annie Oakley and the man which she eventually married, and their contest, which Annie Oakley actually won by one shot. And but I mean, ever since then, she's sort of resided at the back of my mind. And after having seen Annie Get Your Gun on Broadway, I'm glad now to get more of the true story through this wonderful film.
She's such a great and interesting character, such a self-made woman. In many ways, she really embodies the American dream. She had a horrible childhood, as you'll see tonight on the show, and somebody who basically pulled herself up by her bootstraps and her entire family with her out of a childhood of poverty and privation and violence.
One of the things that makes her childhood very difficult is that her father dies after being caught out in a terrible blizzard. And he dies when Annie Oakley is very young. See, now that's not her real name. Is her name Phoebe? Do I remember that?
Phoebe Ann Moses was her real name. She didn't become Annie Oakley until she really started going around and doing shooting contests. And
right. So in the wake of that tragedy, the family loses the farm and some of the children are dispersed, and Annie ends up having an incredibly difficult experience. And the film suggests that it may be difficulty and hardship which in some ways marks her for the rest of her life.
Well, I think that's true, Greg. And I think that basically if you think about what happened to this poor little girl, she was one of many children in this family. Her mother finally finds some work at an insane asylum, basically, And that's certainly not a great place for a little kid to grow up. And by this time, Annie has already started learning to shoot. It looks like her father was the first person to teach her how to use a gun, and she's supplementing the family's very meager income by going out and shooting birds and small game. And then basically her mother just can't keep all these children, so she indentures her out to this family that Annie later will only refer to as the Wolves, who were people who basically worked her to death, locked her out in the cold in an experience reminiscent of her father's death, locked her in dark closets. She finally escapes from them and basically gets herself onto a train and has to trade. When she meets a man on the train, it's as if she's going to get kicked off the train by the conductor, and she offers to trade her seat partner in exchange for the price of the fare, birds that she'll shoot for him because he's an importer of game for the hotel restaurant market in Cincinnati. And that's really where she starts earning her fortune with her gun.
And, of course, she is very, very good with a gun. Little Sure Shot eventually becomes her nickname. At one point in the film, actually, I think we're given such valuable context in terms of understanding just how important competitive shooting was at this point in time, an enormously popular spectator sport in America.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for one thing, the gun, if you think about guns as technology in the 19th century, they're really state-of-the-art stuff. And it's also pretty clear that lots and lots of American households have them. And so in some ways, it would be like something, an everyday activity that a lot of people do, and very, very few people do it very, very well. And certainly for a young girl, and a very self-consciously feminine and wholesome and kind of spunky young girl, to be able to shoot brilliantly, almost flawlessly, was something that was an absolute phenomenon from the beginning of her career.
Hmm. I think it's actually a different contributor in the film, but maybe you remember this and probably know all this as well, but somebody in the film sort of rattles off all of the gifts that it takes, all the different talents that are involved in being a wonderful competitive shootist like Annie Oakley. I mean, when we're talking about wonderful vision and timing and coordination, and I mean, all that goes together in necessitating all the things that are necessary to make this work, that makes it all the more impressive.
Oh, absolutely. And I think if you think about it, she's like an Olympic athlete of our day. The kind of feats, the kind of training that she went through, the focus and the concentration and the single-mindedness at honing one's skill. Is really kind of dazzling.
So at one point, she encounters this gentleman by the name of Frank Butler.
Right.
It's a remarkable meeting of really two remarkable people.
Yeah, and I think it was kind of love at first sight, too, Greg. Frank Butler was somebody who was going around doing shooting contests. Annie bests him in this first shooting contest. He says to her, well, you know, you're a really great shot, Missy. He couldn't remember her name, and likewise, she couldn't remember his name, and she said, thank you very much, Jimmy. And from there on, he called her Missy, and she called him Jimmy, and I guess the rest is history. He basically gives up his own shooting career wisely to manage her, realizing that she is a kind of marketable commodity that's going to take them both to the top and also a great partner for him.
Although one of the things that surprised me most in the film tonight is the fact that the two of them get married, but in the wake of that, Frank Butler, who's already a competitive shooter and has an act with someone else, continues that act with whoever that first partner was of his. And Annie Oakley, for a while, is just kind of an assistant off to the side, involved only in a peripheral way. And it's just the illness of Frank Butler's partner that seems to finally propel her into the spotlight, which she so richly deserves and it would seem for which she was destined.
Well, and I think, sometimes life happens like that, kind of you're waiting in the wings to take her place in center stage. And I think she was incredibly ambitious. I think she was happy enough basically to be on this kind of competitive circuit, whether as an assistant or in whatever capacity. I think she probably had a sense that she could kind of bide her time until her chance came. But for her, think also that this is This is a pretty secure livelihood for somebody who hasn't had much security. So the opportunity to kind of be part of Frank's show came as a, it was a step forward for her.
Hmm. The film also really helps us understand how in these early days before Annie Oakley eventually hooked up with some of these really big shows, the early years were tough years of traveling around on what I guess kind of amounts to a vaudeville circuit or burlesque circuit with actually a fair amount of kind of tawdry, off-color entertainment going on. And it's interesting to draw the contrast between some of what was going on and with who Annie Oakley was and what was important to her.
Yeah, she was somebody who basically made sure that her reputation remained spotless throughout her performing career. And to the extent that really, you know, any kind of attempt to impugn her reputation really aroused her anger and in one case aroused a suit for libel. So this is somebody who is very, very protective of her kind of propriety and her identity as a true woman and a good woman. That you think about that, and that's another extraordinary testament to her will and her drive and her intent to succeed, because at any moment she certainly could have been kind of tarred with the brush of being one of these kind of dance hall girls or vaudeville girls or whatever, and she kind of kept it very, very much on the sunny side.
Right, and well, and the austere side in terms of the outfits she wore and so on. I mean, she was a serious young woman for all the entertainment that she provided. In fact, tell our listeners just a little bit about the kind of feats for which Annie Oakley was famous. I mean, when she was entertaining crowds, what would she exactly do with a gun?
Oh, I mean, she could look in a mirror. She would shoot with her gun pointing backwards over her shoulder and be able to look in a mirror and basically, shoot anything. She shot endless numbers of plates out of the air. She shot cigarettes out of Frank's mouth, and that's always an interesting thing to think about. Sort of William Tell as a young, good-looking girl. She could shoot from horseback. It's really dazzling, the numbers of different kinds of things she could do, and pretty much didn't miss.
She eventually hooks up with Buffalo Bill and this gigantic show which he had put together, A Taste of Life on the Old Frontier. You know, it's so interesting. We read about this happening in the 1880s, and those of us in our modern ignorance might say, well, wasn't the Old West still there in the 1880s? But in fact, this old way of life was very rapidly receding, and so Buffalo Bill and his entertainment was providing this sort of much needed sort of sense of nostalgia. I mean, it just seems like the Old West had barely winked out and was still just in the process of doing this slow fade, and yet people were so hungry to have it sort of potently brought before their eyes in these huge shows.
Well, one of the things we know about Buffalo Bill is that he's participating in the Old West even as he's kind of recreating it in his Wild West. And so the myth and the reality are very much mixed up together, just as you're saying. The Old West is still kind of hanging in there. He will go back, for example, and fight Indians at a time when he's also on stage displaying these shows of fighting Indians with Indians who he's paying pretty well, actually. So there's kind of a mixed up myth and reality theme that goes on with all of this stuff. What's interesting about Annie Oakley's part in that is that this is somebody who never lived west of the Mississippi. She grew up in Ohio. She ends up living in Nutley, New Jersey. She fashions all of her costumes. Her costumes are renditions of what a Wild West girl might look like, and certainly now, I happen to be in Santa Fe right now, and you can walk all over the plaza and get kind of costumes that people think of as Old West evocative clothing, but they're really based on this fiction that Annie Oakley invents, really, of the Western girl. And yet, somebody who grew up in Dark County, Ohio, becomes the embodiment of the Western girl. So she very much has a part in that whole mixing up of the myth and the history.
Hmm. What's especially interesting is when at some point in time a young discovery appears on the scene who is a formidable competitor for Annie Oakley, a much younger woman, actually a teenage girl by the name of Lillian Smith. And
right.
The contrast between the two of them is a fascinating thing to see as well.
Well, it is. And I think, you know, Annie Oakley was determined to kind of maintain her star role. And if you think about this, there could have been a kind of Sunset Boulevard feel about all this. But Annie Oakley was somebody who, I mean, I think she remained girlish right into the time when she was an aging woman. Her hair turns white after this horrible train wreck, but she still manages to maintain this incredibly kind of young, youthful demeanor. And by that time, she stops touring with this show, but she ends up teaching shooting to women especially. So she's somebody who maintains her star power despite whatever competition comes along.
Hmm. It's also interesting to hear in the film about Buffalo Bill taking his huge show across the Atlantic Ocean in the first occasion to England and a few years later to France. I mean, and if crowds were going wild here in America, they were going even wilder for this kind of entertainment over there. The fascination which they had with America and its rough and tumble independent spirit of the Old West, that's a very interesting thing too.
And it remains true to this day. It's very interesting to talk to people who, for example, paint Western scenes or Western museum curators or people who deal Western art. Their market is still so very much alive in Germany and in France. The hunger for the Old West is really still there. And it's interesting, too, to think about Annie Oakley meeting Queen Victoria, who was very, very excited, just as excited to meet her, it seems, as Annie Oakley was to meet the Queen. And you can see these kind of two symbols of the 19th century Western world, the Queen who basically embodied that kind of proper womanhood that everyone would aspire to, and then this fresh-faced young girl from the West
right.
who embodies a Western version of that.
Well, and then Annie Oakley, not many years later, entertaining crowds in Paris in the shadow of this brand new Eiffel Tower, which has just been constructed for the Paris exposition. In the film, we are also shown a precious few frames of moving picture footage, which Thomas Edison captured of Annie Oakley in action. I mean, something done in his studio. And primitive though it is, it's a wonderful look at what she could do in her prime. Unfortunately, it also points to something which would eventually wash all of that grand scale entertainment away. The coming of movies was also, in a sense, the beginning of the end of Annie Oakley's stardom.
Oh yeah, because basically instead of having to truck all of these people and all of these horses and everything else out to a place where people would be entertained, you could just show a picture of that. And certainly that's going to be a big change. But if you think about it too, the idea that Thomas Edison would want to capture Annie Oakley, both of them are people who are really very much a part of the bringing of modernity to the United States. In the case of Annie Oakley, it's the idea that women can master whatever cutting-edge technology it is, whether it's getting on a steamship to go and entertain Queen Victoria and stand in the shadow of a symbol of modernity, the Eiffel Tower, or to shoot a gun, to be familiar with the state-of-the-art of personal weaponry. And Edison, of course, you know, wanting to be able to capture that speed and that motion and that precision that Annie Oakley is also measuring, that's so much of a kind of symbol of how the modern world operates. It's really a kind of moment of modernity.
Absolutely. Incredible. The film also talks about a very turbulent period in Annie Oakley's life when she is the victim of, well, it's a little hard to know, careless journalism or an honest mistake or someone going out of their way to sully her good name. But an erroneous story is run in a number of newspapers across the country suggesting that she is destitute, trying to pay for her cocaine habit. Tell our listeners what happens in the wake of that erroneous news report.
Well, she's devastated by this kind of bad publicity. First of all, publicity is her life's blood. But second of all, she's somebody who has been so very much about protecting her reputation and living by her reputation. She sues them for libel and ultimately wins.
And it's, however, a long, hard odyssey. It takes years of her life as she pursues one newspaper after another, after another, after another. I mean, it says a lot about who she was and her sort of dogged determination to restore her reputation at whatever cost.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think if you think back to the kind of psychology of that, here is somebody who, it's pretty clear that during that really heinous period with the people that she called the wolves, was subjected to just probably some kind of unspeakable violence. And you think about somebody who picks up a gun in order to redress that injury and to try to come to terms with it. And this is somebody who basically says, if I'm attacked, I will attack back, and no one will ever harm me again. And there is a kind of guts about that that informs everything she does, whether she's out riding a horse around in the ring, shooting at targets, or whether she's pursuing a lawsuit.
Hmm. As someone interested in Annie Oakley and Frank Burns for that matter, how does one sort out between the facts and the legend which springs up around somebody as charismatic as Annie Oakley? I imagine that is not an easy challenge.
I think it's almost impossible to do that, because you find yourself living in the realm of speculation when you've got somebody who worked that hard really to edit the story of their own life. You think about their marriage, which by every account I can figure out, it was a very happy and a very loving marriage, but it's a marriage that yields no children over all this time, and you find yourself wondering, well, how did that happen? You know, what's that about? I, frankly, have wanted to write a screenplay about her for years and basically figure out where her childhood fits into all of this and what that relationship could have been like. And it's certainly that horrible train accident that was so disabling to her and really did kind of end her performing career to a great degree. That certainly could have been physiologically devastating to her and crippling to her in many ways. But there are an awful lot of gaps and blanks that I think she worked hard to keep blank from us, and we'll never know.
Mm. Well, fortunately, there is at least something that we can know, and there are all kinds of photographs and journalistic accounts of what she was able to accomplish. And those blurred Edison frames of footage and other film footage from very late in her life, one of the last times she appeared in public shooting, actually very shortly before that very serious accident, which ended her career pretty much. A fascinating career for a woman who was like no other woman of her time. And I suppose that's something else that's intriguing for you to study, is Annie Oakley as a woman in her time.
Well, yeah. I mean, in many ways, there were plenty of people who were out there on the road, whether working as actresses or working as Harvey girls on the trains going west or trying to find some kind of place in the spotlight. But the difference, I think, with Annie Oakley is that she just managed to, in some ways, I think back to the wonderful book Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, and the blonde goes into the Ritz in London, and she sees the debutante, and she says, oh, I saw that debutante, and she was so cute, and she's been cute for 40 years, and when you've been cute for 40 years, it starts to get really historical. And I think there's something of that with Annie Oakley, that she remains youthful and is able to kind of embody an American girl a long time after most people are able to kind of keep that fiction going. And at the same time, to be very, very active in managing her own career, managing her money, managing her image. She's a self-made woman of the 19th century. She embodies a kind of American dream that very few women have been able to aspire to even.
Virginia Scharf, one of the participants in a really fascinating documentary film for American Experience that aired back in 2012 called Annie Oakley. Excerpts from that can still be viewed on PBS.org. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, speaking of PBS's American Experience, I'll be speaking with the writer and producer of a wonderful new documentary film premiering tomorrow night called Change, Not Charity, The American Disabilities Act. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Our weather forecast today is for skies to eventually become partly sunny, but it will be very windy once again. High temperature today of 49 degrees, but winds 15 to 25 miles per hour with gusts up to 40. Clear skies but cold overnight with a low of 28 degrees. Sunny tomorrow with a high again of 49 degrees and very similar forecast on Wednesday. Thursday, we'll see the upper 50s. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.